Welcome, everyone, to You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle.
Welcome.
It's a podcast about movies and wine, and for those of you who don't know shit about either or both of those topics, my name is Jamie Harrison Rubin III, Esquire. I'm the wine guy.
You're not a lawyer. He's Jamie. He's the wine guy. I'm Scott. I'm the movie guy, and we're here to help you. Each episode, we pair a movie that I love with a wine that he loves.
We tell you why we like them, how they're made, and why they work. Hopefully, we find a pairing that works. Usually, we do not.
Almost never, especially when we don't try. Today, we're on to part three of our six-part white and red wine tasting flight menu, the Court of Master Sommeliers Tasting Rubric Seminar miniseries flight. Did I get that correctly?
You did it perfectly. That's exactly what I wanted this miniseries to be called.
Well, there we go. I just stumbled into it. Jamie, what are we drinking today? This is the final white, right?
This is the final white wine of our six wine flight. For this miniseries, if you're just tuning in with us, I decided to take us through some of the Court of Master Sommeliers curriculum by way of taking us through a flight of wines. The reason for that is I'm taking the goddamn exam in May, and I have a lot of anxiety about it. And this, in part, is a way for me to complain about it, which is culturally how I deal with things. Scott, don't give me that face. Us Jews, complain about things. That's what we do. But that's how we process.
You guys don't have, like, you know, a monopoly on that. Like, plenty of people complain about
things. No, we just do it better than everybody.
All right. You're not doing a very good job so far. But, okay. I'm indulging your anxieties here. That's fine.
I appreciate it. It also has the added benefit of forcing me to study some things that maybe I wasn't quite as tuned into. Like this here. Sauvignon Blanc. Today, our final white wine of the flight is Gurgitch Hills Fumé Blanc 2019, available at crushwineco.com for $33.95. I told you that this wine was aromatic, oaky, and rich, and using exactly none of those descriptors, Scott, which movie did you pick?
That's right. Well, normally we do pairings, and then sometimes we just don't bother. And I decided to make thematic pairings to the overall arc of Jamie's miniseries, his focus on his education. So I've been taking us through some of the foundational works of largely Western cinema, the film school classics, I've been calling them, movies that I saw multiple times throughout my undergrad experience, getting my bachelor's in, I don't even remember what it's called. I think it's communication studies.
I believe. At your damn degree.
It's in a frame in a box in the closet. I can't find it. So today we are watching this iconic piece of surrealist cinema from Louis Buñuel and from Salvador Dali. This is 1929's En Chien Andalou. The movie is presently available to stream any number of places. It's French. It's in the public domain. You can watch it on YouTube. I believe the Wikipedia has a stream of it. I personally watched a very nice print streaming on the Alamo Drafthouse's VOD service.
They had one of those.
They do. They don't really use it as much anymore. They started having one a little bit before lockdown happened, and then they were using it as the platform for their virtual version of like their Fantastic Fest Festival, which is how this one is still available streaming. It's free. You just need to make an account, give them a name and an email address, and you can make an account there. And it is a beautiful print of the movie that you can check out. Otherwise, watch it any number of places. But yeah, we'll get into our thoughts on it in a bit. But Jamie, I think we should open up some wine.
Yeah, I opened mine already. I jumped the gun. And I wanted to check it, make sure it wasn't corked, and, you know, give it a little taste. I've already given it a little.
I noticed. This will not be a blind tasting for you today.
Well, I mean, they never really are. I am the one that chose the wine.
While I'm getting my glass poured here, you can answer a quick question for me.
Yeah.
So you said a traditional Master Somm tasting flight is three reds and three whites.
That's right.
What about, like, the rosés and the orange wines and the bubbles? They're just left out?
They are left out, yeah. Yeah, that's something that I have an issue with, and I don't really 100% know how to solve it either, because, you know, I've tasted a lot of rosé in my time, and I think establishing what the court describes as typicity is maybe a little bit more difficult with rosé, because it's a category that wineries typically feel can go outside the norms of their region. I don't know. I think that there's value in adding it. It just would be difficult whites and reds, no bubbles, no orange, and no sparkling. And I wish that there was, because those are categories of wine, with the exception of orange, that I like to drink a lot. Not a big orange wine guy.
You're not a big orange wine guy. Yeah. It seems strange. What is typicity?
So
is it a fancy word for typicalness?
Typicity is the idea that a wine made from a particular grape from a particular place will have a set of flavor and aroma indicators that, when tasted blind, will lead you to that place. For example,
yes,
Cabernet Sauvignon from Napa Valley. In the typical style, it is full-bodied, high tannin, high alcohol, medium acid, black and blue fruit, a little tiny bit of like green vegetal note, and a ton of new French oak. There's more nuance to it than that, but that's the general idea. And as much of that comes from you making the wine in the same way from winery to winery as it does from the grape itself and the place itself. And so the idea of typicity I find to be sometimes flawed, and we're going to get into that with this wine.
All right, so this is our third attempt at somewhat gamifying Jamie's blind tasting rubric that the Court of Master Sommeliers, I certainly have asked you this before, sommeliers, I feel like sometimes recently I've heard you pronouncing it with like just a hint, like you're nodding at the L, but not actually enunciating it.
Sommelier is typically...
Sommelier.
Yeah.
Sommelier. All right. But so it's the Court of Master Sommeliers Advanced and Master Sommelier Deductive Tasting Exam Format. Now, Jamie, you just told me that this is a new rubric or a new format?
They updated it. This is the roughly the same thing that I have been working with for most of, at least since I took advanced. But they added a few like specifics to it.
Are the specifics interesting?
Not that much, no.
Okay.
No, we don't have to go through.
We don't need to go through.
Definitely no value in us like picking apart the new fucking tasting grid.
I don't know. Maybe there would be like politics about it that you would dash about it.
Well, the politics are they're trying to be better and largely like not doing enough and not moving as fast is like as fast as they should is the summary of CMS post 2018 when they started getting called out for being overly secretive and not at all transparent and very exclusive and, you know, just not the best organization. And a lot of people like myself have questioned our desire to be a part of it.
Right. This is their Oscar so white moment.
Right.
They're having a come to Jesus moment, a bit of a public reckoning.
And they brought in a CEO, specifically someone who is not a sommelier. Someone who like comes from the nonprofit world to run the organization. And a couple of months after they brought this person in, she took the introductory sommelier exam, which like, why the fuck? Why? It's just like the dumbest thing.
I mean, there's value in having an outside perspective, and you can be a good manager without being like invested in
sure.
the nitty gritty of what you do.
It's kind of a bad look, I guess, so soon after doing this, specifically noting people's concerns with it being too insular.
I don't know. I guess, isn't this a demonstration that it's no longer too insular? You know? Like, look, we're even letting some rando off the street who doesn't know how we do anything into our local club.
Take this test. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's get into it. So this is the rubric that you will be graded on. We're not going to set a clock here, but... You've already been tasting, so you've been jumping the gun, but are you prepared?
I'm ready. I'm ready to go.
All right, so Jamie, first we're going through the sight categories.
Yep.
Describe the clarity of this wine.
This is a clear wine.
Clear. How about the intensity of color?
This has a moderate intensity of color, maybe moderate minus. It's pretty pale.
Ooh, I just drank some and don't like it. What is the primary color? So this is a white, so your options here are water white, straw, yellow, or gold.
I would say straw.
Straw?
Pale
water,
straw.
Water white is not appealing. Okay, secondary color. White wine, the options listed here are silver, green, copper, gold, and brown.
Yep, little flecks or hints or like close to the rim. I would say hints of gold in this wine.
Hints of gold.
Mm-hmm.
Green can be an option. That is bonkers. Okay.
Yeah. Super young, like Gruner Veltliner or Sauvignon Blanc or Albarino can have like hints of green.
Hmm. All right. How about, rim variation is for red wines only, staining for red wines only. We'll get to those next time. How about tiering? I'm not seeing any tiering.
High tiering. So the tiering, when you do the swirl in your glass, watch from the waterline and see like how big the tiers that form are and how slowly they fall.
There we go.
Bigger and slower they are, the higher the tiering. And this is very high. Yeah, this is high.
Okay. And so this the bigger and the slower, that's more tiering.
Right.
Got it.
And this is a way of assessing surface tension, which can lead you to like dissolved things in the wine. So higher levels of acidity or sugar or glycerin or anything that gets dissolved in the wine.
Is that any crossover with body? I would feel like higher body would also mean that you'd get more of
the
surface tension.
So this is a way of corroborating those two things.
Okay. And then last thing for sight is gas evidence. Jamie, are you detecting any gas evidence?
Only from the other end.
I really thought you were going to make a little fart joke out of that, but you're saying I'm full of hot air. I see. I understand. That was a cheap shot. That was hypocrisy. So you detect no gas evidence in this glass.
No evidence of gas in this wine.
All right. Well, on nose, let's see what nose has to say. Does nose detect minor presence of faults?
Hold on. We might as well back it up real quick just to give context on
the gas evidence.
Yeah. If there was evidence of gas, if I was seeing some bubbles, that could be evidence of either a wine that was bottled under a Stelvin closure, because sometimes those retain gas, or an extremely young wine, one that's still sort of effervescent just in the bottle. This has none of that, so I'm guessing that this is, or were I actually blind tasting this, that would be the start of my assessment of age.
All right. So moving on to nose. Minor presence of faults such as barnyard, nail polish remover, caramel, nuts, dried fruit, struck match, balsamic vinegar, or other. Wow. Struck match is very specific.
Yep. No evidence of faults. This is a clean wine.
I concur. How about aromatic intensity on a scale between delicate and powerful?
It is a powerful intensity of aromas.
And this is the one that we assess based on how far away nose is from glass to
smell. I can have this
it.
Down on my desk and still I can smell it.
It's one of those. Cannot. I can smell it here. Nope. No, it's gone. It's gone. Like 2.5 inches away from the tip of my schnuffer. Nothing. Nope, nothing at all.
Well, just trust me then. It's a powerful intensity of aromas.
I trust you. All right. Age assessment. What does nose say about age assessment?
This is a youthful wine.
Youthful. And can you describe the fruit character of it, Jamie?
Yes, we're getting primarily citrus fruit here. Very tart citrus. There's a lot of grapefruit, which I know that you love. That's like sort of the primary driving factor. Grapefruit juice, zest, pith. The whole damn thing. There's like a Granny Smith apple situation happening. All the fruit is pretty tart, and there's a gooseberry note as well.
A gooseberry. If I were to ask you what gooseberry smelled like, are you going to give me any other answer than gooseberry?
It's one of those things that you have to eat a gooseberry. Like it's a high tone.
That's a no.
It's somewhere. I'll try.
Okay. All right. This is also progress, Jamie. You're trying.
For you, Scott, I'm trying.
You're trying to meet me where I live, and I appreciate that progress.
It's somewhere in the vicinity of that tart grapefruit, but it maybe has a little bit more suggestion of sweetness to it. Is a gooseberry? A gooseberry is like, what's another fruit that I can, maybe like a less aggressive lychee? You know how lychee's like incredibly perfumed.
Yeah.
If you take away that like aggressive floral perfume of a lychee, soften it a lot and move it a little bit towards citrus. That's maybe how I would describe a gooseberry.
All right. Gooseberry. These were descriptive words. It wasn't just, it tastes like a gooseberry. I can't help you. You have to eat a gooseberry.
You should started eat a gooseberry. There. Gooseberries are tasty.
I mean, it sounds like it tastes like grapefruit, and grapefruit is gross, so I don't want to eat a gooseberry.
It doesn't have the bitterness of grapefruit.
Well, I will tell you, Jamie, according to the CMS deductive tasting exam format here, you could have just said other. They're looking for in a white wine you to either say tart citrus, sweet citrus, apple or pear, stone fruit, tropical melon, or other.
I'll make sure to just say other when I'm taking my exam.
They're timing you, man. You got to do six wines in what, 25 minutes? Like, you could just say other next time.
Six wines in 25 minutes. Shit is stressful. You can do
it. You can do it. It's
I've
okay.
done it before.
All right. Describe to me the condition of the fruits in this wine.
So I kind of did that already because that I usually just roll that in to the same thing, but they're very tart, a little bit underripe. Or is the condition.
Okay. How about non-fruit flavors? Can you give me first the non-fruit flavors that you deem come from the grapes? And then after that, I would like the non-fruit flavors that come from the wine making. Mm. This is very specific. I like how granular they're getting here.
Yeah. It's important to distinguish those things. So yeah. Non-fruit flavors that I get from the grape, I'm getting a white flower, I would say, gardenia. Kind of quality. It's very much in the background. This wine is all the way about fruit, but that sort of flower, or even almost like green tea kind of aroma. There's like a slight bit of minerality here. Once again, very much not driving the wine, but still present. Like a wet slate kind of thing. And then from the winemaking, I'm getting a yogurty kind of aroma, which I attribute to Lee's contact. And I'm getting a slight bit of vanilla, like vanilla bean, which I would attribute to some amount of oak. But I think it's faint enough that this is all old oak.
They got some real specific ones on here, including some I've never heard you use to describe wine flavors.
Why don't you tell us?
So from grapes, they've got flowers, green bell pepper, asparagus, celery, grass, herbs, tobacco, black pepper, white pepper, ginger, honey, petrol, eucalyptus, chocolate, mocha, and mm-hmm. other. So chocolate and then chocolate coffee are separate items.
A thing that I didn't say that is definitely here is that green bell pepper aroma.
Green bell pepper. I'm getting some green bell pepper on the palate. I'm working ahead of you here.
Yep.
And then from winemaking, so bread, dough, yeast. Okay, we've discussed the yeasty things before. Mm-hmm. Beer, cheese, rind. Oh, no. Cheese rind. No comma in between. Cream, sour cream, butter, yogurt, peanut shell.
Yeah.
Not peanut, but peanut shell.
Correct. Yeah. Peanut aroma would be an indication of oxidation. Peanut shell is an indication of Lee's contact.
Hmm. Toast, marzipan, stems. I guess just any kind of stems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like a green, like stems.
Like a woody stem. Yeah.
Yeah.
Bubblegum. Cigar box and yep. other.
Mm-hmm.
And they're saving the surprising ones right at the end there for me. Not because it's mocha. Coffee, not an option, but mocha is a thing you could smell. Cigar, not an option, but cigar box. Now that could be a thing you could detect.
Yep. All right. We're still on nose.
We are still on nose. So now, Jamie, I need any earth notes you have.
Earth
notes.
I'm not really getting any earth on this wine.
Hmm.
Just a little minerality, not anything earthy.
I concur. How about, all right, so a little minerality. Can you describe the minerality? I think you already said a wet slate.
Yeah,
slate
wet
thing,
slate.
Right? Wet
yeah.
slate? No.
Pretty faint, but definitely present.
Hmm. They've got flint on here. I don't think you've ever described a wine as flinty before.
Flint is funny that you bring up flint. Flint is a specific descriptor. Usually of Sancerre or Puy-Fumé. And those are famous Sauvignon Blancs from the Loire Valley in France. Puy-Fumé is the namesake of the Fumé Blanc that we have here. And we'll get into that a little bit after we get through the grid. Or we could do it now.
No, it's fine. We'll get to it when we get to it. We're not even really talking about this wine yet. I mean, we are. I must observe, I'm very proud of you and a little surprised at your demonstrable growth. As you said, Pooey like three times in a row, and you never smirked or cracked an eyebrow or made a dumb face or made a joke about poo gas or anything. And like, this is you're really growing up. I'm real proud of you.
I mean, I'm 38 years old. It had to happen sometime, right?
Jamie, in a Tim Tam that we dropped yesterday, you say that you can't have milk because it gives you ouslay oopy pay.
Listen, man, it gives me the ouslay oopy pay, all right?
Yeah, I know. All right, how about oak?
I believe there to be used oak on this wine.
Ooh, it doesn't sound good when you put it that way. Used oak. Okay.
That's I never even considered that, you know, to someone who doesn't know about wine, that used oak doesn't sound great.
I mean, I understand it conceptually. It is barrels that have been previously used. It's not new oak. It's
right.
Old and oak.
It's new. It's been, oak imparts more flavor because you have the, like, it's the virgin oak and you get right. the flavors of the wood. Used oak is more neutral, less impactful on the wine.
It's used. It's soiled. It's oak that's been sullied. Ooh. All right. All right. We're done with nose. We are now on to palate structure. Please describe the sweetness here. We are on a spectrum. Boy, man, it's like they're maybe actually assessing the thing, the beefs that I have with their spectrum. A spectrum between bone dry and lusciously sweet.
Mm-hmm. This is dry. Not bone dry, dry.
Dry. Yeah, I detect no sweetness. Bone, but all right, dry.
Bone dry would be like searingly, like almost too dry. You know, yeah. Like the acidity is so high and there is so little both sugar and glycerin to balance it. That it, you know, it's the kind of wine that I've certainly described on this podcast before as needing food, kind of for that reason, to balance out the extremity of it.
The bone dryness.
Uh-huh.
All right. How about acidity?
By the way, we didn't snicker at all about bone dry. So that's both of us growing.
I mean, you know, it's also like, that's pretty low-hanging fruit right there.
I'll give you some low-hanging fruit.
You really are getting old. They're hanging that low.
They really are. It is yuck. Distressing.
Horrible. All right. Everyone's so glad we're on video now, because now there's the slimmest chance of a threat of that happening. Acidity, James. Describe the acidity of this wine.
This wine is high acid. Maybe medium plus. It's like maybe just a hair short of high.
I agree. How about alcohol?
Medium plus.
I'm going to check you here. The bottle says, Surgeon General's warning, contains sulfites. Am I not seeing it? I don't think it says what the percentage is on here.
It by law, it has to.
Well, by law, somebody fucked up. It ain't on here.
No, it is. Bottom right corner in like really faint ink of the front label, 13.5.
Of the front label. Oh, not just but super tiny. Why are they trying to hide it?
By the little horsey.
Why are they trying to hide it?
I don't know, man.
That's like within the safe zones for your printing, margins of error. That is too close to the edge.
I agree.
13.5. All right. And 13.5, we consider
medium plus.
Medium plus? All right. Mm-hmm. How about body?
Medium plus body.
The acidity is all confusing me. I can't tell body when there's high acid. How about phenolic bitterness?
There is a moderate phenolic bitterness to this wine.
And phenolic bitterness is what we say when we're talking about white wines. And if we're talking about red wines, we say tannin.
Correct. And phenolic bitterness is if you take a sip, swish it around your mouth, and pay attention to the back corners of your tongue, that little, after you swallow, that little like bitterness that lingers on the back corners of your tongue.
I've never thought of my tongue as having corners before.
But you understand, like towards the back of your mouth.
I concur.
Get that little bitter bite. Yeah, that's phenolics.
All right, so we've done the phenolics. No tannins to discuss. Texture. Note when apparent. When would texture not be apparent?
So they're looking for, you know, the specific texture of tannins. Are they silky tannins? Are they really rough like sandpaper? Or in a white wine, you know, is... Does it verge on having tannin? You know, I think we talked last time about the Chenin Blanc having a bunch of texture to it. Chenin Blanc is a grape that I find has extreme texture. It's almost a little bit astringent in your mouth. I don't think that there is notable texture to talk about here. It's pretty silky, pretty easygoing.
All right. And now moving on to proper palate. So, fruit. Confirm from the nose. Has anything changed?
Pretty much the same. Fruit's a little riper on the palate than it is on the nose.
How about, and that's fruit condition. Yeah.
Yeah. All yeah. Right. But we're you know, confirming palate to nose. I'm getting that grapefruit thing. It's sort of tart. Granny Smith apple, gooseberry. But the big change is that rather than getting a bunch of pith and zest from the grapefruit, I'm getting more flesh and the fruit's a little bit riper.
All right. How about non-fruit? Can we confirm anything from nose?
I think on the palate, where it's pretty dominated by fruit. I'm really digging for that floral component. I'm really digging for the minerality. The lees contact, that like sour cream yogurty thing, definitely present. And the green bell pepper, like that snappy, fresh green bell pepper, definitely there on the palate.
About earth. Can we confirm earth?
No earth. Confirm no earth.
Mineral? I'm getting a minerality on palate.
I think it's more faint than it was on the nose.
Well, I wasn't getting it on the nose, so I'm disagreeing with your palate and nose.
Okie dokie.
Oak?
Confirming old oak.
Confirming used oak.
Yeah. A little bit of vanilla bean. It's got kind of a softer fruit profile, indicating that maybe it's not like so tight as though it was aged in stainless steel.
How about balance? This apparently is a yes or no question. Yeah. On
this
the rubric.
Wine, this wine is in balance, more or less.
What main characteristics or elements dominate the wine?
The fruit.
That's the fruit?
Mm-hmm.
That is the main characteristic?
This is a fruit-dominated wine.
How about length of finish?
Medium plus. I'm still tasting it. Yeah, it goes on. And then moderate complexity. I'm guessing that's the next one.
Yes, complexity is the next one. So you would say moderate complexity.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Initial conclusions, Jamie. Possible grape variety or varieties.
You know, if I were blinding this, my initial would be my possible grape variety is Sauvignon Blanc. Obviously, it's aggressively fruity. There's that bell pepper note. This is Sauvignon Blanc. I might throw in another aromatic grape just to hedge, just to show that I'm thinking about aromatics. So say something like Gewürztraminer. But the acidity really disqualifies Gewürztraminer. So if I'm going into it and I'm confident, I would just say possible varieties include Sauvignon Blanc, and that's it.
Mm-hmm. How about that climate?
Coming from a warm climate.
Possible countries, you can't blind it because you're not blind. You've read the label, you picked the bottle.
But I know I said warm climate, so I'm going to, like, my next thing is the United States. That's it. If I'm confident that this is Sauvignon Blanc and that's the only thing I said in my initial conclusion, then I'm kind of bound to say United States because there aren't testable Sauvignon Blancs from warm climates other than the United States.
Okay, that was my question, because there is Sauvignon Blanc from other warm climates, but the U.S. is the only testable one.
Correct.
So, like, all that New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc.
Oh, shit.
Not testable.
New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc is testable.
Oh,
It's just not warm
Who
climate.
Who knew a warm climate it's, where Sauvignon Blanc is
from? It's not
warm
climate. It is New World, though. So that's like the difference. You didn't ask me if it's New World or Old World.
I did skip over that. That's true.
Yeah.
I realize that now. New Zealand is not a warm climate?
No.
Is it because of all the mountains?
It's because it's pretty high latitude.
But Mordor always looks so hot to me.
Well, that's because of the volcano, Scott.
Right. And the Blight of Sauron.
Right.
Well, anyway, that's just one region of New Zealand. That's just the one island, not the other. can you pretend to have an initial conclusion on the age range?
Yeah. I would probably, if I was legitimately blinding this, I would probably say 2 to 3 years. But that would be incorrect, and I wouldn't have been paying attention to myself. The use of oak would imply a little bit longer aging, so properly I should say 3 to 5. It's showing very youthful, so I think I would just immediately jump to 2 to 3, and then I would be like, you know, getting the vintage wrong, because this is a 2019 wine.
All right, so now we're on to final conclusions, and now they want you to give them grape variety or blend, country of origin, region and appellation, official quality level, official style category, and vintage, meaning the year.
Mm-hmm.
So
some of those things don't apply to this wine, like official quality level and official style.
Because this is a non-European wine.
Correct. And those things are not regulated.
There aren't official things in other places, in the free world.
Correct.
Right.
In the non-socialist world.
I want to be clear. I'm my only beef with European policymakers revolves around their wines. Otherwise, I'm on board with the socialism. That all sounds great.
Very much on board with the socialism. Yeah.
But they got to get the fuck out of here with regulating all these wine bullshits. My question to you is initial conclusion and final conclusion. On the exam format rubric here, these things appear to come one after another.
They do.
Is that your experience of it? Like you make initial conclusions and then after those, you make a final conclusion right away?
Mm-hmm.
What is the virtue in doing both? Is it just so you can like talk your way through it and then narrow it down until the specifics?
So in the interest of specifically getting it right, yes. In the interest of demonstrating knowledge, it's also to show that you have an idea of possible laterals. In this case, there really aren't possible laterals. This is a Sauvignon Blanc from a warm climate. Like, it is what the fuck it is. Next episode, we're going to be doing Pinot Noir from Burgundy. Spoilers. And there will be some laterals that I will discuss. Some, like, very reasonable things that you could say. Like, I think that this is Pinot Noir or possibly Gamay or possibly Cabernet Franc or even possibly Sangiovese.
Sangiovese!
Correct.
I miss Sangiovese.
Well, we have a Sangiovese in this miniseries.
Another spoiler. Thrilling. Explain this to me. So if you get the country of origin wrong, but your initial conclusion about old world or new world and climate and possible countries was correct, you maybe don't lose all the points. You get points for getting some of the initial notes right, but then if you said Spain and it was France, you would lose a point, but not 5 points or something.
Correct. Yeah, okay. It's about taking it in total. You know, like if you maybe, let's say I throw out a completely oddball note that the examiners don't believe is in the wine, and I end up getting the wine wrong as a result.
Okay.
If the conclusion that I drew was reasonable, given that note that I threw out, I will get some amount of partial credit just for having that theoretical backing. So it's set up, you know, not rewarding only accuracy, but also your holistic knowledge of the thing, which I do find to be valuable, especially noting that flavor is so subjective, not just person to person, but day to day, week to week, etc. You okay there?
I don't really like this one.
Yeah, I'm having a tough time with it, too.
The acid is very high. Those like bitter grapefruit things I'm not grooving on. I couldn't identify it until you said bell pepper. But then there's like that like crisp, but also kind of bitter, like raw green bell pepper thing that I'm not really grooving on. And I'm somebody who like has eaten green bell peppers like apples before. And this, ooh.
Like Chairman Kaga from Iron Chef Japan, just biting into a bell pepper.
I guess I am like him, yeah.
Did you ever watch that show?
I think I've seen maybe one episode of The Iron Chef in my time.
Iron Chef, the original Iron Chef Japan, like some of the best cooking television that has ever been made. It's
better
just
than
like,
Julia Child? Better I than said, Yan Can Cook?
I said some of the best, Scott.
All right, fine.
Definitely better than fucking whatever. Like Beat Bobby Flay competition show is the highest rated right now.
Well, that show is just, or I don't know, whatever the last time I saw a Bobby Flay competition show where like he goes to like a diner and he's like, you, I'm going to invite you out to Hollywood and we're going to shoot a competition and we're both going to make your recipe. And if I make it better, fuck you. I'm embarrassing you on television. Fuck you, Bobby Flay.
Exactly. Fuck you, Bobby Flay.
This is not helping anyone.
Yes. It's an ego trip and it's stupid and you have all the advantages in the world, you know, given your like training and experience and also home kitchen advantage and basically just fuck you, Bobby Flay.
Yeah. Also, I'm not on board with everyone deciding that. I'm on board with people sincerely and earnestly liking Guy Fieri now.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know when the like, to generalize, the pretension of certain Italian Americans that has trickled down through those people being on TV about like really nailing the Italian pronunciation of certain types of cheeses and cured meat.
Oh God, that shit annoys the fuck out of me.
I don't know when or who decided that we should also apply that to the pronunciation of Guy Fieri. But now everyone says Guy Fieri, and that I'm not cool with. I think it's nice that people enjoy him for what he is because, you know, he's a fucking dingus and a goofball, but like at least he's not out there insulting and challenging people in their diners, drive-ins and dives.
He's out there for a good time. He's having a good time. He wants he's other people to have a good time. And like everything that I've heard about the guy, apparently people who work for him are intensely happy and well taken care of and have good wages and good benefits. And like,
that all
I'm
sounds great.
Fully on board with Guy Fieri. I also like, doesn't he refer to himself as Guy Fieri, not Guy Fieri?
That might be him just trying to pass, though, on television.
Sure. I do find it annoying when Americans generally try to, like, pick specific foreign words to pronounce in an exaggerated way correctly.
Jamie, hang on. Oh, shit. I forgot. I gotta go to the Wegmans and get some mozzarella.
And by the way, anyone from Italy, from the country of Italy, would never, ever in a million years say less syllables when the possibility is to say more syllables. It's mozzarella, if it's anything at all. But it's fucking mozzarella. Come on.
Come on. Get off it. Come on. Yeah. Anyway, not super keen on this wine.
This wine is not my favorite, although this is one of those wines that if I, as I've described before, when I do a six flight of wines, when the timer starts, I will take a moment and sniff each glass just to see if there's one that like sticks out to me, one that I think that I can nail easily, or one that I know I'm going to be confused on and I can sort of allocate time appropriately. If I stick my nose into this glass, I'm breathing out a sigh of relief, right? Like I know that there is Sauvignon Blanc here and all I have to do is spend my time figuring out where it's from and what year it is. This is a layup that I'm not likely to receive on my master's level exam.
Aren't those things, I don't know, it would seem to me that assessing the fruit and non-fruit and nose and palate characteristics are more readily apparent than figuring out where it's from and what year it was made. I guess the former things tell you the latter things, but like those things seem easy. To me, it doesn't make sense to be like, oh, thank God, I know this is Sauvignon Blanc. Now I just need to narrow it down to one place on the entire earth and one year in all of the history of the production of wine. That is not intuitive.
It's, sure, but maybe contextualize it this way. When we're talking about a place, if I know that it's Sauvignon Blanc and I know that it is a Court of Master Sommelier's testable variety, I know that it's coming from New Zealand, the United States, or France, period. So, well, like,
you're welcome for reminding you about New Zealand, Jamie. You forgot?
I forgot about New Zealand.
And if you pass the test and it happens to be on a New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, I would like half of your pin.
I was studying New Zealand this week for the fucking exam, and that's probably why I was just like, file that shit away.
Not very well, it seems. Oh, buddy. Okay. You can do this. I believe in you. You got it. It's okay.
Do you want to know what the Maori term for the Southern Alps is?
No.
It's Kitiritiri Ote Moana.
To be clear, I did want to know, but in my brain, I thought you were asking if I did know. Yes, I do want to know. Kitiritiri Ote Moana.
Yes, Kitiritiri Ote Moana. That's,
are you
that's
proud of yourself for memorizing that?
Yeah, I'm very proud of myself.
Do you think that memorizing and committing that to memory is why you forgot that Sauvignon Blanc is made in New Zealand? Something that even I know? Like, are we prioritizing which bits of minutiae we're committing to memory before our great big test?
I also know that the area of Gimblet Gravels in Hawke's Bay, New Zealand, was once the site of the Ngaruroru River, which got diverted due to an earthquake within the last 100 years. And so, yes, to answer your question, Scott, I think committing those bits of minutiae to my brain is what contributed to forgetting what Sauvignon Blanc from that Sauvignon Blanc could be from New Zealand.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, it's bad.
It's you have a lot of shit you got to cram in there.
Uh-huh.
And I don't envy you, and I wish you well. I do not like this wine, but I will continue drinking this, my second glass of it.
Yeah, I don't like this wine either. I
no, it's stanky. It's not a cat pee stank, but it's a stank, and I'm not enjoying the stank.
It's so aggressively aromatic, and you know when I said it's balanced, I kind of mean technically balanced, but the flavors aren't balanced at all, right? It's all this aggressively tart fruit. And then what should be a complexing and pleasant note of like the vegetal note that green bell pepper just kind of comes off as obnoxious and annoying.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty unpleasant. I do not care for it.
I do not like it here or there. I do not like it anywhere.
Yeah. It is accidentally, because I made no plans whatsoever, and this is the first time I'm opening this bottle. It is accidentally maybe a good pairing for Ancien Andalou. a movie that is deeply unpleasant.
Yeah, that was not my favorite watching experience. No. But we'll get into that. Let's talk a little bit about.
I'm not trying to jump ahead. Tell me more about the maker, the makings.
Let's talk a little bit about Sauvy Bobby.
Oh, Sauvy Bobby. That's another bit of vocabulary that I enjoy.
That's brand new to me, by the way. Sauvy B is a thing that I've been saying for a while. But a friend of mine.
You told me about Sauvy Bobby. Yeah. On our last recording. It
was very, very recently. She just went to Australia to do harvest. She's currently harvesting in Australia because it's the Southern Hemisphere and March is when they do harvest because seasons and the tilting of the earth.
Yeah, I'm familiar with the tilting of the earth. Thank you. I don't know that you need to explain that to anyone else who lives on the planet and is an adult, but okay.
Listen, man, some people don't know. Some people don't know that it is fall down there right now.
I mean, my child knows that.
Well, that's your child's ahead of the curve.
It's true. He does know things. So Sauvy Bobby.
Sauvy Bobby. Yeah, my friend went to Australia and now calls it Sauvy Bobby. And I'm mad that I didn't know about that until a couple of weeks ago. And so now forever, Sauvignon Blanc will be Sauvy Bobby.
Sauvy Bobby. Is that an Aussie thing, a Kiwi thing, or a both thing?
I think it's an Aussie thing, or maybe it's just a thing that she made up. I don't fucking know.
You know what's tricky? Like, Sauvy Bobby, not the easiest words to say if you're working on your bad Australian accent.
Sauvy Bobby, those
are not the vowels that are easiest to say doing a bad Aussie
voice. It's true. It's really true.
Anyway, please continue.
Sauvignon Blanc has been, you know, one of the more important grapes of the world for a long time, partly because of French colonialism, but it's the main grape of Sancerre and of Puy-Fumé, which are hugely popular, especially in the latter half of the 20th century to today, regions in the United States and the world more broadly. It's funny how many different winemakers I've met who credit Sauvignon Blanc as like their entree into winemaking. The winery that I worked with on Long Island, McCary, Joe, the owner there, mentioned to me that Sancerre was like his aha wine. Same with John Williams at Frog's Leap. John Williams, the winemaker, not the famous composer.
We've done this before. I know it's not the famous composer. Although, if Johnny Williams fucking was a winemaker, I would drink that shit up. Or at least I'd give it the same try that I gave to Francis Ford Coppola's wines.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to try Mary J. Blige's wine, honestly.
I didn't know that was a thing, and now I do as well.
Yeah, it's called Sun Goddess, and it is Pinot Grigio from Friuli in Italy. And she does it in, remember we had the Scarbolo Ramato when we were doing Matrix Resurrections, the one that was pink.
I remember those words and that one of them was pink.
So she does, her wine is in the Ramato style. And I think that that is interesting and ballsy and I want to taste the wine. And that's all I have to say about that. Sauvignon Blanc first made its way to California in the latter half of the 19th century. It was first planted in Sonoma by a guy named Agustin Harethzi, who, if you're studying wine, is a person that you know about. He founded the first commercial winery in Sonoma, which is called Buena Vista Winery, which is still in operation today. He was a Hungarian immigrant. He became a mayor in some Midwestern city for a while and then made it out to California to start his winery. And made a huge impact by planting a lot of grapes and making a bunch of wine, but also showing that you could make sparkling wine here, showing that you could grow Sauvignon Blanc, Pinot Noir, Cabernet Sauvignon, that kind of thing. And it wasn't just the Spanish grapes that had been planted previously.
I really like how you realize that you set yourself up for like some kind of profound or surprising realization. He made a huge impact by
making a lot of wine.
By making a lot of wine. He planted some grapes and then he made wine and he made a lot of it and that was his impact.
Are you done?
Yeah.
I'm no, you're good. Not done.
Here, I'll just mute myself and you can continue and I'll get the gigs out of my system, right? And mute.
Oh my God. Okay, so when it really started to take off was when Sauvignon Blanc got planted in the Livermore Valley in the 1880s by a guy named Charles Wetmore. He got cuttings of vines from Chateau d'Yquem in Sauterne. Chateau d'Yquem, widely regarded then as now as the best producer of Sauterne. And Sauterne is a dessert wine that's based on Sauvignon Blanc and Semillon. So he'd got these vines, brought them to the Livermore Valley, which is just south of San Francisco in the like central coast area. And that vineyard eventually came to be owned by the Wente family, who are now the dominant producer in the Livermore Valley. But they then went on to propagate those wines, and that clone, the clone that was planted there, became isolated and became the dominant clone of Sauvignon Blanc that is currently planted in the United States and in New Zealand. So we've got a pretty long history of Sauvignon Blanc in California. Fast forward to the middle of the 20th century, when Robert Mondavi is starting to make a name for himself and also make a name for the Napa Valley. There were plantings of Sauvignon Blanc in the very famous Tokalon Vineyard in Oakville. Oakville's an area of Napa Valley, which is, you know, largely considered to make some of the best wines in California. It's some of the most valuable real estate in the country also. It's where Opus One is. It's where the Mondavi Winery is. It's where a lot of like famous estates are.
And there's lots of oak trees there?
Probably.
This was a sincere question.
Yeah, my guess is that there were until they cut them all down to plant vineyards.
I mean, I've been to Oakville. Pineville. I'm assuming there's, you know, a pretty hearty amount of non-deciduous trees there.
Sure, but how many chestnut trees are on Chestnut Hill in Philadelphia, Scott?
Well, not any anymore. There not probably just, were some, though.
There were a lot. But then the great chestnut blight took out basically all American chestnuts.
Okay. My point is...
It was named for oaks that were there, I'm sure.
Right. The naming of the thing comes from a thing that maybe isn't there anymore.
Yep. So in Oakville, there is a vineyard called Tokalon. Tokalon is the vineyard where some of the best wines from Robert Mondavi got grown. It is the site of this first surge of international popularity of American wine, and specifically of Napa Valley wine, as a result of the efforts of one Robert Mondavi. Another thing that he did from this area, not just Cabernet Sauvignon, was Sauvignon Blanc. He made it in a very powerful style. He wanted to create a signature Sauvignon Blanc style of the Napa Valley, and so he bottled his under the name Fumé Blanc. Fumé is the French word for smoke, so that's both a nod to the fact that Sauvignon Blanc is grown in Puy-Fumé, but also the fact that they're using a bunch of oak on the Sauvignon Blanc, which can contribute to a slightly smoky aroma.
And it just happened to predict California's current signature wildfire seasons.
Oh my God. Ouch. Ouch, though, Scotty.
You burnt, I guess. That's, literally, it was a double. Oh, literally that was so burnt. Bad. Oh, it was bad to begin with. And
Scott,
then
you should
mean.
Take it back.
I'm going to rewind it back. I apologize. At first, it was just a bad joke that wasn't meant to be mean-spirited, and then it was a triply bad joke that was kind of mean-spirited. But smoke taint is bad. We don't like smoke taint, but we like French word for smoke in the title. That's right. Cool.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If you ever get ahead of things and just assuming that the wildfire seasons are going to get worse, maybe you could start bottling something, assuming that smoke taint will become inevitable, and then eventually the taste will change and that it'll become a desirable attribute.
I was actually just about to suggest that that's the thing that should happen, because there are all of these people out there who stake their livelihood on these grapes, and maybe as wine professionals and then as the consuming public, we should accept that this is going to be a flavor in wine going forward, and try to find ways to not just mitigate it, but integrate it into wines.
That's just pragmatic.
Yeah.
And smoke taint ain't going nowhere.
I like where your head's at, Scott. I was literally about to launch into that whole thing, and here you are.
Smoke taint.
Yep. I mean, the fires ain't going to stop.
They're not going to stop. Now, here's the test. And this is where Jamie always gets in trouble because he's bad at naming things. What would you call Jamie's smoke-tainted wine?
I would just call it taint.
You would just call it Jamie's taint. And then there's just a little picture of you going.
Or how about Taint Reuben?
Is this Saint Reuben? Is that the idea?
Yes. With a picture of me praying with a halo.
I mean, that's pretty sweaty. Yeah, okay, sure. I open this door. You're doing the best that you can on short notice. Fine. That's great. Taint Reuben. That's what we'll be calling it.
So these are some of the things that we are encouraged to know about Sauvignon Blanc for this exam, that like it has this history, that this is the reason why it tastes the way that it does. And this original style, this style of Sauvignon Blanc, the the richer oaked style of Sauvignon Blanc, sometimes blended with Semillon, as it is in Bordeaux, is the one that is quote unquote testable by the Court of Master Sommeliers. My beef.
Here comes. I'm braced. Drop is that some beef.
There aren't that many examples of this style being made today anymore. There's Gergich Hills Estate that still makes a Fumé Blanc, partly because Mike Gergich, nay Miljenko Gergich, he's a Croatian immigrant who came to the United States to make wine, and he used to work for Robert Mondavi, and that's one of the reasons why he still labels Fumé Blanc. Mondavi and Gergich are two of the only ones who still label it Fumé Blanc. Other people label Sauvignon Blanc partly because the grape is just popular and people know the name now, but partly to distance themselves and make a style of wine that's a little bit more fresher, that maybe emulates the Loire Valley a little bit more, such as Frog's Leap, Mathiasen, Ludi, Duckhorn, a bunch of wineries that are making wines from 100% Sauvignon Blanc, a little bit earlier picked, all stainless steel, less lees contact, no oak, more emphasis on freshness and lower alcohol. So I find those Sauvignon Blancs, those Sauvy Bobbies, to be as indicative of the place that they come from as this one, but I like them more. They're tastier, and I think that they're more representative now of the zeitgeist in California. So my argument would be that the court like keeps up with the times and stop making us taste these wines that are like sort of vanishing, and that clearly neither you nor I like. Not that we are the end all be all, but like if the two of us agree on this,
that's a pretty bad sign for the wine,
right?
Yeah,
you know, maybe we integrate some other things, and also it would make the test a little bit harder. As I said, this wine is a little bit of a layup. You know, it's obnoxiously aromatic. Some of those other wines are a little bit more subtle. They're maybe a little bit more high acid. They might represent, or rather they might taste a little bit more like European wines. So you would have to really pay attention to place them in the United States. But the astute taster would note the fruit character, would note like a slightly elevated alcohol content and place it in the New World, in North America. We're not saying New World.
We just did. We just said New World.
Listen, man, it's been like a decade of this. I'm trying to unlearn it. I'm trying.
No, I get it. I get it. I understand. Well, I have nothing insightful to add there. No deep, thoughtful commentary. Except
I'm sure you agree that like I agree this that is this to be a relevant bad. Certification, that maybe we should move with the times, right?
Yeah, sure. I only have your perspective on these things to go on. But yeah. I think the more important thing is that I don't like it, and I don't want to have to drink more things like it. And I'm surprised that you also don't like it, because I find this to be equally gross to other things that you have advocated for recently.
Yeah, I don't like this wine at all. I'm not really pleased to be drinking it. I honestly kind of thought that I would like it, because it's a style that I don't often drink, and I tend to like richer styles of white wine, but this one I just feel is like, it's out of balance, it's too bitter, it's not doing the thing. It's not making me make that sour face that you're making quite as badly.
Oh, this is the face here. Here, we'll make sure that Zoom is recording my side of it, because I'm making noises now.
The stinky cat face.
You just made noises and then Zoom wasn't looking when I'm... Oh. Yeah, don't care for it. Not fun, not pleasant. It's got fruit, which I like, but it's got grapefruit, which I don't like. And there's bitter, and the acid is way too high, and there's not a lot to balance out the acid, and I find it distasteful. And I'm normally down with your Sauvy Bobbies.
Yeah, I like Sauvignon Blanc a lot.
This is a very extreme. This is all the bad things about Sauvy Bobby, and none of the things that I might like.
The only thing that it has that we like is the fruit character, or is fruit at all. I'm not pleased with this wine.
Yeah. Gross. Not a fan.
Yeah, not a fan. You got any further thoughts on the wine or about anything that I said?
I think I'm giving them to you right now, which is...
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about a movie.
Un Chien Andalou.
An Andalusian Dog.
That's right. Were you familiar with this at all?
Not even a little bit.
Even a little bit? Nope. Even the image of the razor blade going across the eye, you had never seen that before?
Mm-mm. You warned me about it.
Yeah.
But no, not ever in my view. Was that a pig's eye that they cut open?
So there's apocryphal stories all over this movie. There's not, you know, a ton of like records of the production. They didn't have like a unit, like photographer who was there, like documenting everything. There wasn't a fucking publicist. I'm sure there was a camera, like a light, and you know, probably a lot of absinthe or something, and not a lot of the traditional stuff we would think of for like
probably for, some for opium too, Scott.
I don't want to generalize except about the absinthe. I'm assuming there was absinthe.
Right.
But yeah, there's tails. It is any of a number of different animals. It's either a lamb or a goat, and whatever, you know, beast of burden it was, its fur and skin was bleached white so that in that brief glimpse on screen, you think it's a human's face with the eye getting cut across. Deeply distressing and upsetting image, though.
Sure is.
And is kind of the origin of the entire project.
Really?
Yeah. So I'll back it up here.
Like a U-Haul truck.
That's right. If you haven't seen the movie, it's 16 minutes long. I find it deeply unpleasant, which is kind of the point, as we'll discuss. And it's like a foundational piece of surrealist cinema. And it's very important, and its importance is weighted, especially in its inclusion of film studies and in rankings of the most important films of all time and in cinema education. And I don't know, I might end up before this is done, if I complete this glass of wine, make an argument that its importance is wildly overstated and that I think it's garbage.
I'm excited for that argument.
Which is just normally not my way with these things. But Al Shian Andalou, you can't even describe the plot, really.
Is there a plot?
I mean, there kind of is. It's
they give you like a timeline. They get like 8 years,
and the timeline is nonsense. I think those title cards should just be taken out of the movie because they almost imply like a continuity of time and some kind of like logical or rational world that is otherwise not depicted in the movie at all.
Correct.
It is entirely evocative of dreams and dream language. And it starts with this seemingly unrelated image of a man with a razor blade looking at clouds moving across the moon. And then in a match cut image, with a person almost in like a pose, like he's their barber, slices a razor blade across their eye and like blood and viscera and eye goop starts leaking out. It's genuinely a horrific, but very evocative and very, very, very famous image in like the annals of movie history.
I mean, yeah. How often do you get to see the vitreous humor dripping out of somebody's eye on film?
Not super often. Eye stuff, I have a problem with eye stuff in general. I can watch all manner of movie violence, but eye stuff and finger stuff, I just can't. I can't work with that. Finger stuff really bothers me. Yeah, okay, violence against fingers.
Okay.
Like, is something I can understand. Like, if somebody gets gut shot in a movie and they're screaming in pain, like, you know, fucking Tim Roth and Reservoir Dogs, like, screaming for the entire movie because he's bleeding out.
Right.
The performance is great and I can empathize with that, but like I can't imagine what that pain is like. But like, you know, fingernails getting ripped off or fingers being broken, like, oh, that's just so tangible and plausible to me, and I can't truck with that.
It is. I'm currently dealing with a wound on my pinky finger delivered to me by a cat, and it's like a small little cut, but on the tip of your finger, it's just this ever present like, fuck this shit, ouch.
It hurts so much. It hurts so much.
Scotty, it hurts.
It hurts.
So eye stuff.
It starts with the eye cutting. We were talking about the eye cutting.
Yep.
And then one of the more evocative scenes is like there's this man and the woman in the apartment. They're sort of our main characters. And they're looking out the window as this beautiful young woman is like standing in the middle of the street. And then she gets run over by a car and he's watching and he becomes very aroused. And then he starts groping the other woman who is with him and she's not interested. And we get like cross-faded images of he's groping her through her dress, but then we see bare breasts and then we cut back to his like ridiculous aroused face. And then there's like a dissolve and now he's actually, while he's groping her breasts, he's actually imagining that he's groping an ass. And then he gets very excited about that. And then she runs away and tries to fight. And he's got ants climbing out of his hand.
Yep.
And the ants continue and he's pursuing her and there's threats and there's danger. And it's
And then eventually we find the hand dismembered on the street.
The hand is dismembered on the street and it's in a box that we have seen before. That box is of some significance.
And then the box we find later towards the end, broken on the shores of an ocean.
Right. With two different characters walking along.
Question mark.
I think she's the same, but the man that she's with is different.
No, I think they're both different.
Hmm. But then also at one point we see, yeah, that there's an exchange of violence between our, not protagonist, but like the male lead and some other better dressed version of himself.
Yep.
It's wild and it's crazy and it's important, but I don't know, man. I think it's kind of bullshit. I think the whole movie is kind of bullshit.
And here we go.
Well, so to back up,
why is it important?
Well, it's all tied in together. So the origins of the movie are in the late 20s in France. Two Spaniards meet up together. It's Dali and it's Buñuel, and they're in their 20s, and they've got a real like Jamie attitude about themselves, where it's like, fuck this, fuck the establishment, fuck the bourgeoisie. And all of their bullshit and their pretension and fuck the high art world. And it's all nonsense.
Can I just say something?
Yeah.
Fuck this and fuck the bourgeoisie.
There we go. That's great. Jamie, you're part of the bourgeoisie, okay? You're certainly not the proletariat going out for your master psalm exam.
Oh, God, yeah. Well, yeah. That's fair.
So the two of them get together and they have this like shared love of surrealist art and of, you know, like anarchy, and they happened to share dreams one night, and the one of them had a dream about the image of the cloud moving across the full moon, and then that being a blade slicing across an eye, and the other one had a dream about a bunch of ants pouring out of a hole in his hand, and they were like, oh, great, this sounds like a movie, let's make it. So, like, in 5 days, they make this thing with money that they borrowed from Buñuel's mom, and they put it together very, very, very quickly, and, like, they had two rules, and the first rule was it has to be, and I'm sure it wasn't, like, a regimented rule system that they came up with, but they had to agree on everything, and if one of them had an idea that they loved and the other one didn't love it, the idea went out the window and we're not doing it. And then the other rule was basically it all has to follow dream logic and we will not unpack in the making of it the subtext of the dreams. So like they wanted to make a Freudian dream movie, but they themselves were not interested in exploring or assigning meaning to any of the symbols that were on screen. So they finished the movie, they put together this screening, and they invite like the wealthy, the established, the people who are important, especially in the French art scene.
The cognoscenti.
The cognoscenti might be a good word for it. And the way that they tell it, and most of the stories about this movie and this early screening are apocryphal, and that the two of them continue to change their stories about it over the decades since. But I believe it was Buñuel said that, the way he tells it, he had pockets full of stones just in case the audience was so enraged by the film and so insulted and so upset that he would have something to throw back at them as a means of self-defense. That they intentionally were being provocateurs. They wanted to piss people off. They wanted to make something that was loaded with charged imagery of the eye and the sexual violence and imagery and poetic imagery that is not explained. They thought that they were real iconoclasts and that they were breaking down walls. And this was an entirely a middle finger to the arts establishment. And the way it's told in the history, in the tales, is that it was received with like thunderous standing ovations and applause. And everyone loved it. And Buñuel and Dali were like, what the fuck? We hate you people. And this whole movie is giving you people the finger and mocking you and your sensibilities. And now you love it and you applaud it. And they were like very upset that no one was mad at them or tried to kill them at the end of their screening. So
this is not going to come as a surprise to you at all, but I can empathize with them in that moment. I get it.
It's not that I'm surprised. It's that I don't even know what you're talking about.
Other
than that you think you're an iconoclast.
No, if I had done something specifically to bother people.
Yes.
And in fact was the opposite. Actually, no, that's not true. As long as the response was extreme, then I'm happy. The way to kill a Jamie is to say that you have no opinion of him.
No, the way to kill a Jamie is to turn your back on him and pretend he's not there, and then he loses all of his power, like Queen Mab in the 1999 PBS Merlin miniseries.
Yes, exactly.
Exactly like that. Sam Neill just gets everyone to turn their back on Jamie, and then Jamie's like, no, Merlin, no, don't do this to me. And then you just like melt and dissolve and disappear.
Sure.
Because your power is gone. Because your power is derived from attention.
That is, yes, please. Pay attention to me.
Right. Oh, and then the real cherry on top of the whole thing is that this movie gets the two of them invited to the official designated group of surrealists. They were invited by like this budding surrealist movement in Europe in the 20s and 30s. They were invited to join the surrealists. They were the first filmmakers who were invited into it. And so it elevated them to this huge position and kind of, in a way, launched both of their like, quote unquote, mainstream like careers in the arts. Even though Dali really didn't go on to have much more involvement in film, and Buñuel did a lot more weird, dreamy, surrealist stuff, but like his works that have lasted didn't really come until decades later. The reason that this movie is taught in schools is because of the surrealism of it. The fact that it is not really interested in narrative. It's not interested in spatial continuity. It's taught as a counterpoint to Hollywood style, invisible editing, and that type of continuity. And it's taught because it's made from two people who went on to be very important artists, and that this is a movie that a lot of other significant filmmakers have pointed back to and said that it's like one of the most important films for them. And while I can see all of that, and I think that the fact that it falls more in line with like a poetic school rather than like a prose school, if we want to think about like different styles of filmmaking and the world that they convey.
Which we talked about. Battleship Potemkin.
And montage.
Montage, yeah.
Yeah, and this is more poetic, less in terms of the idea of like meter or a rhyme scheme, and more about the actual like imagery, and that it's not interested in creating any kind of semblance of reality. While I see all of that, and there's stuff in it that's evocative and powerful, the whole just like fuck you sensibility of the thing, I find kind of annoying. And I don't know. I see the significance and I see why we point back to it. But it took up way too much time in my film schoolins for something that is ultimately like a bullshit lark from two guys who were just trying to point their finger in the eye of the establishment.
But, and just being the devil's advocate here.
Advocating for the devil. Go right ahead.
Regardless of their intent.
Yeah.
Like, can you talk a little bit about the impact that it's had? Like, where can we find the DNA of this movie today?
Certainly not in like mainstream American movies, the type of stuff that one might normally consume. But like you can see the traces of this in the films of David Lynch, right?
Okay.
Like as a big like landmark example, like Lynch is very much dabbling in a surrealist kind of worldview and evokes a lot of the same dreamlike logic and dream imagery that you see in this movie, and is in a way is like a provocateur in the same way. Now, I think Lynch's stuff is a lot more successful. Obviously, somebody like Lynch is building on sort of like barriers that these guys broke down. And not to say that I like Lynch's stuff more because he's more interested in, I mean, relatively conventional narratives, conventional compared to Ancien Andalou. Yeah, it was never something that like really clicked for me in school, other than like, all right, I need to know this for the exam. I need to know where the image came from. I need to know the political context of the movie. But like, as far as a piece of like cinema, it's just so inherently repellent. And I find it nihilistic. Like, it means to provoke you and piss you off and upset you. And it means to be repulsive. And then the more I would ever learn about it, that was actually the MO for the filmmakers. It's like, I don't know, man. What if you just, like, made something sincerely instead of ironically? What if you really wanted to, like you could do this. Like, there are examples of dreamlike surrealist films that are experimental and are provocative that also aren't intentionally alienating, you know? We're going to talk about one in our next upcoming episode as a real counterpoint to this movie. But yeah, I just find it so repellent, and the worldview that informs it, I find so boring. Like, it's very much like a fuck you, you know, angry young man in his 20s kind of pissing off everybody type of thing. Did you like this at all? Did you enjoy your experience of watching it?
No.
No, it's deeply unpleasant.
Yeah, it's not, you know, there are some things that I find interesting, you know, the ants coming out of the hand, the like artifice of it. And I think the way that it was filmed was quite evocative. And you have this guy like looking at his hand and you really are wondering what's going on. And then you get the middle finger of them just moving on from it and then returning to a disembodied hand that doesn't have ants coming out of it. And you're like, well, what the, is there going to be any kind of a resolution to this? And I find, I guess, some value in contemplating what meaning could be there.
Yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of meaning there, but does it add up to a cohesive or coherent statement about, like, the closest thing I find to, like, to a coherent worldview that's expressed by the movie is about the tension between Eros and Thanatos, right? Like going back to the Greeks and like Freud pulled from this a lot, the tension between the sex drive and the death drive. Right. Like the dude sees the woman run over by the car and was already aroused. And now he's super aroused and becomes violent and how those two things kind of feed into each other. And that a lot of that comes out of the ants coming out of his hand or maybe his hand. Maybe it was somebody else's hand. But that the ants easily a signifier of death and decay and the body falling apart, being, you know, dissected by insects. And that only furthers the sex drive of it. Like, it's all there. And I think there's interesting things you can pull from it. But I don't actually, like, it just seems so apparent to me that this is just bullshit posturing and pretension and hypocrisy. And it also makes perfect sense to me that it was lauded by the established art world at the time.
Why does that make sense to you?
Okay, so you really liked Triangle of Sadness, right?
Uh-huh.
So Triangle of Sadness, a movie that is like a huge middle finger to the wealthy and to the 1% and the upper crust, right?
Yes.
That filmmaker, Ruben Ostlund, his previous movie is called The Square and is a movie about the fine art world in Europe, the high art world of Europe. And it is a critique of all of their hypocrisy and their corruption and their pretension and how they embrace something immediately because it's lauded, not because they actually derive any meaning or value from it. And that the people who think that the thing that they're doing is full of shit end up believing the hype of all of it. These two movies both won the Palme d'Or at Cannes and were met with like enormous applause from the exact people that they are ridiculing.
I guess that
the Cannes audience is the type, is like the fish in a barrel that Ruben Ostlund is pointing like a Gatling gun at. And they love it and they eat it up. It makes perfect sense to me that this movie was applauded at its time. And yet I cannot help but see the thing as just juvenile and iconoclastic and and provocative for the sake of just, we're just being shits. We're just being little shits and we hate everything. And I resent the nihilism of it.
I'm having a difficult time because I didn't enjoy the movie.
Yeah.
But I wanted to hear like some kind of a perspective on it. And you also didn't enjoy the movie.
Yeah.
But one of the reasons you don't like it is that it has a fuck you attitude. And I just love a fuck you attitude. And so I want to argue with you.
Because you're saying fuck you to me now.
Right.
Boy, you really just can't help yourself, can you?
I can't. I really can't. But you're right, Scott. You're right. And I'm
it's
with you.
Bullshit. It's just a bunch of bullshit.
And I didn't have any of that context. And I watched this movie, I don't know, a half an hour before we started recording. So a full 2.5 hours ago. I wanted to come into this just having sort of that, the like raw experience of the movie. And my raw experience of the movie was like, what happened and do I / should I care? And by the time we got started talking about it, I was pretty firm that I don't. But I wanted to hear, like, you point to Lynch as an impact point for this movie. Are there others?
Sure.
Are there counterpoints? Was there like a counter movement against this type of thing?
I mean, it's not like this movie, like,
or this is play. The counter. This is just like,
yeah, this is the backlash. And movies like this and of its type, like, it's not like they, you know, played on screens for weeks at a time around the world, right? Like even 100 years ago, like, this is still a niche piece of work.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, if we're looking for like traces of it, like, I'll stick with things that we've talked about on the show. So She Dies Tomorrow has traces of the surrealism that is present in this. Not that this movie invented surrealism, but it was like the major landmark, the breaking in point of surrealism into cinema.
Right.
And She Dies Tomorrow with its dream logic and its surrealistic editing and the way it disorients you from space and time and uses non-narrative imagery in ways that evoke themes or subtextual things or Freudian elements, like, is very much in a school of thought with this type of movie, while also not being like repellent and nihilistic. I mean, you look at the works of Robert Eggers. Like, you loved The Lighthouse. I don't know that you've seen any of his other films, but like, there's definitely a dreamy sort of Buñuelian surrealistic streak all throughout his films, especially that one. Not so much his movies before or since then. But yeah, there's that type of like horrific dream imagery all over The Lighthouse. And that's another movie that like is trying to be provocative and repellent and alienating to the audience, but I just feel like it's much more successful.
Could you talk about nihilism in this context? Because you say that this movie is nihilistic, and I'm not entirely sure that I understand what you mean by that.
I'm not saying it's politically or philosophically nihilistic, but I personally, my sense watching it is, and which is only reinforced by my understanding of its creation and the additional research that I did to remind myself, because it's been fucking like 12 years since I've been in film school. Longer. Oh boy, much longer.
We're getting old.
And I try not to do this. I try to just assess the thing for what it is,
mm-hmm.
and not allow my understanding of the background to influence it too much. But it is a little difficult with this one, because we spent so much time in school talking about the context of it. My sense of it is it's a lark. It's a whim. It's meant to provoke. It's meant to piss people off. They weren't actually interested in the meaning that they were putting into it. It strikes me as a work from people who their only intent is to piss someone off. They're not interested in meaning. And when you spend all that time and effort to make something and you don't care about what it means, that to me smacks of nihilism. That to me sounds like meaning is unimportant. The world is meaningless. My efforts are meaningless, and I'm only here to be an asshole. So I might be stretching our definitions of nihilism.
That's why I wanted you to expound on it, but like, yeah, that makes sense.
It's not unfair. I'm not opposed to making nihilistic movies, but like, I don't know. It just feels like posturing. This whole movie just feels like posturing and bullshit.
Sure.
And while I can see the importance of it, and I think the craft of it is fine, like they're doing fascinating things with the imagery and with the compositions and with the fade
ins and outs.
Yeah, I mean they're doing great stuff, and they're doing it in like genuinely thoughtful and interesting ways. The only thing that I really value about this movie is that rewatching it, it reminds me just how dreamlike movies are. Like, movie language in general borrows more from dreams than it does from like theater or literature.
Uh-huh.
Right? Like the idea of a cut just jumping from one location or time to another without explaining it. And the audience just intuitively, we come to understand it, not just because we've been watching movies our entire lives,
but because we've been dreaming our whole lives.
Because we dream. Yeah. And like, this movie pushes it further and does cuts that substitute people or other characters or other places or just crazy ass fantastical imagery. But yeah, it is nice to be reminded, like, oh, right, all movies are kind of dreamy in their own way, except for, like, the blandest and most boring of them. but beyond that, like, I don't know, man. Like, fuck you. And fuck all the film school curriculums that place this as a centerpiece of importance, but, like, aren't interested in showing their students any films from anybody outside of America, Europe, and, like, two filmmakers in Japan.
Right.
Which is all just very poor. And these are like major, you know, areas that I'm still making up for in my own personal evolving cinema education.
And likewise, I mean, in my wine education, you know, yeah. I'm trying to learn all of the European, American, whatever we place importance on stuff. But privately, I want to know more about the other things, about hybrid varieties that are easier to farm, about, you know, ancient world wines from Lebanon and from Georgia, that are maybe where all of this actually started, before the French decided to export their culture to the rest of the fucking world. Or I guess also in concert with England exporting French culture. But yeah, it's a wonderful crossover, and particularly with this wine, that I don't think is indicative of things that are important or interesting today, but does have importance in the history of wine in general, I don't, you know, similar to you not knowing if film schools should center on Chien Andalou, I don't know that the CMS should center Fumé Blanc as a style.
Yeah, it's something I wrestle with a lot when I think about my education in the world of cinema. I turn to invert the tables on the pretension of the world of wine.
Mm-hmm.
But it's something I grapple with a lot, which is like, not only, as I've said before in this miniseries, like a lot of it was just like seeing clips from movies that were historically significant, but seeing them out of context and not having the time to actually witness something in its full and really discuss them like in a significant way. It was like, all right, you got to learn about montage editing. You got to learn about invisible Hollywood style continuity editing. You need to learn about the things that fucking Griffith brought with, you know, action and spatial photography and left to right movement and what all of that conveys. You need to learn about color. So we're going to talk about, you know, like Technicolor, and we're going to talk about Vertigo, which I talked about in terms of color, like four different classes. But just like it all felt very much like, I don't know, the collegiate version of like standardized testing, like
right,
watering it down or boiling it down to just the bullet points and the historical signifiers that are important without really reconciling with like, I don't know. I was in college in the late aughts, the early aughts to the late aughts. It took a while. But like it was very difficult for my professors to get most of, you know, my contemporaries to like really engage with a lot of this stuff. I can't imagine showing Gen Z people this movie and getting them to like react in any kind of way. But like there are other things that do similar things to this that you could show them that people my generation or a younger generation would actually engage with. And I don't truly know what like the film education world is like right now. I'm pretty removed from that. But I would just feel like this is still in a place of significance, and that would be disappointing. One encouraging thing. This movie, I think for the first time ever with the 2022 Sight and Sound list, is no longer on the list.
Hell yeah.
In 2012, it was like in the 80s or 90s, and now it's bumped out of the top 100. Like it's still, you know, ranked on there, but it's no longer in the 100.
Fuck you guys.
Well, it was just kind of encouraging. Like, you know, there's other Buñuel movies that are better. Salvador Dali made more significant contribution to the world of the arts than this bullshit thing that he did in his 20s when he was mad at people. I don't know, man.
Yeah.
So yeah, this is the first movie I've ever picked for the show that I just don't like. And I picked it when I was outlining what I wanted to do for the miniseries because it was a significant thing. And I saw it probably five or six times in film school, but then rewatching it last week, like, oh, right. Fuck this movie. Like I'm old enough now to look at it and say, fuck right off. What a bunch of horse shit.
Well, accidentally, we've got a great pairing.
It works out nicely sometimes. I'm going to have a little sip of Gergich Hill's Ancien Andalou Sauvie Bobby here to wrap things up. Yeah, the bitterness, the high acidity, the lack of enjoyable things, the stank.
Yeah, I don't like it.
It's a happy accident on a pairing, though.
It is. Yeah, I think both of our respective industries of expertise would do well from just like taking a step back and centering other perspectives and taking a look around at like what is important today and how we got here and why we got here and finding different lenses through which to explore that.
It's tricky, right? Because like they want to weigh what's historically important. I don't know. You can separate what's historically important from what's artistically important. And I don't mean like capital A artistically, like to weight something, because that's just talking about history again, but to convey the plurality of ideas and flavors and styles and genres that are out there. You can do that without just resorting back to the same handful of producers or filmmakers that are significant in part because they've been taught as significant for decades.
It'd be interesting to see what kind of things happen if wine and film education start to decenter things like this wine and that movie.
Who knows? I don't know. We shall see.
It's a whole new world, baby.
I'm just a guy sitting here drinking wine I don't like, talking about a movie I don't like. I got no further predictions to make. I'm not a film professor.
Oh man. Yeah. I don't have predictions. Well, I've got some predictions for the wine world and some hopes, some dreams,
hopes and dreams.
Did we do it? Are we done?
I think we're done. I think we're just about wrapped up. I have to pee. So that's great timing.
Yeah, for sure. So next time on
next time on. Jamie, we've concluded the 50% of the CMS tasting that would have you do white wines.
Mm-hmm.
So next time, I'm checking my notes here, we'll be drinking a red wine.
That's right. Red okay. wine.
Red wine. Red wine.
Oh my God. Yes, red wine. We're going to Burgundy. I talk about Burgundy a lot on this show because it's like important and
it's
shit.
It's important. It's Burgundy. It's big. It's red. It's expensive.
It's very fucking France. Expensive. And I'm also a hypocrite because I really like to drink it. but we're doing the Jérôme Chézeau Bourgogne Rouge 2019, which is available at Crush Wine Co. For $29.99. It is a Pinot Noir from France.
I do love Pinot Noir.
I know you do. And what movie did you choose to go along with that?
Well, paired to your Pinot Noir, we are sticking in the world of black and white, short film, dream logic, surrealist narratives. But this one, I actually think is worth a damn. And we're going to be watching Maya Deren's landmark Meshes of the Afternoon. This is a 1943 feature film from the artist and filmmaker Maya Deren, who also stars in the movie. This is one that I saw many a time in film school, and it was one of those ones that, like, unlike Ancien Andalou, actually improved for me and became richer over time with multiple viewings. And I haven't seen it in a good 10 years, so I'm very much looking forward to watching it again with you. Meshes of the Afternoon at present is available streaming on the Criterion channel. If you have that, if you don't, subscribe. They've got a 14-day trial, and it's like the best streaming service. Criterion right now has a terrific and very well-timed curated series of films called Michelle Yeoh Kicks Ass. And it's just like a bunch of great Michelle Yeoh Hong Kong movies, and also equally, if not better, great. More great. Been a couple glasses. I hate this wine.
Greater.
Greater. There we go. That's the word. Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. But yeah, check out Criterion. It's also available on Canopy if you have a library card with a library that's a participating member of Canopy. And also, it's a movie that's like 90 years old, so you'll be able to find it on any of the various online platforms for things that are that old. But Meshes of the Afternoon, Maya Deren, 1943. Check it out. It rules. I'm looking forward to it.
I'm looking forward to it as well.
I think you'll like it. I think.
Well, we'll see, Scott.
We will.
We shall see. I think you're going to like the Bourgogne Rouge.
Oh, well, then I'm even more excited because I love me a nice red wine, but sometimes I don't like the things that
sometimes
you
they're not nice.
I mean, honestly, Jamie, the way that we've been going this year, I'm basically dreading opening every bottle that we're doing for the show because I think I've liked one of the 8 wines we've done in calendar 2023.
You're in your I don't like this stuff phase of wine education.
Is that a phase? Do we all go through that? All of us wine professionals?
Yes, indeed.
Did you have your I don't like this phase?
Sure did.
How did you get out of it?
Well, you just keep drinking. You got to drink through that, Scott.
That's your solution to everything.
You got to drink through
just
it.
Just drink
okay?
through it. Good
Thank
Lord.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us.
Thank you, everyone.
Please follow us on the socials at Bigger Bottle Pod and email us with any questions, comments, concerns, or international reviews you'd like read on air at biggerbottlepod@gmail.com.
Also the socials. We're on the Tim Tams now, and we're on the U of Tube. So if you think that Jamie and I might be very handsome, having listened to our voices for so long, bad news, you're going to be able to find out. Watch all of our episodes on the YubTub. This episode was produced and edited by Scott Hudson. That is me. Our art is by Ross Connor. Thank you very much, Ross. And thanks to Rebecca McCracken for helping out with social media and project management.
Remember, everyone, drink more wine, watch more movies. It's good for you. We fucking promise.